Welcome, Capital Raisers. Brandon Cobb joins me today to break down raising capital, marketing, starting a development company, forcing appreciation, and built-to-rent investing. Are you guys ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships in BTR, talk shop on raising equity. If you'd like to join me at the Family Office Club Capital Raising Titans event in Miami on August 1st, or explore our capital mentorship program, use the link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show episode 271, and it starts now. Rock and roll. I got Brandon Cobb on the Capital Raiser Show. Welcome, my friend. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. It's an honor to be here.
It's going to be fun, man. So you're in the built to rent space. You do some capital raising. You got a vertically integrated development construction company. So we can chat a lot about that type of stuff. The Capital Raiser Show season 3 now brought to you by Pitch Decks, our friends at the family office and Richard Wilson's company. So welcome to the show, dude. How about we start with a little bit about your background? How'd you get into development and raising capital and all of that good stuff?
Yeah, so once upon a time, my life was very different. If you told me 8 years ago that I would be doing these neighborhoods and rezoning property and building developments, I would have looked at you like you had six heads. I actually don't have a story about how I hated my corporate job and had to get out of it. I loved what I did. My background was in medical device sales. I was a young guy in his 20s in the operating room every day, rubbing shoulders with surgeons, getting to train the hospital staff. I actually love what I did. I had a lot of intrinsic motivation to sell products because I got to see the before and after effects that my products were having on patients. I thought that was really cool. So I was the guy, if you were an athlete and you had a torn labrum or rotator cuff or torn meniscus, or you had a torn ACL or needed some kind of allograft reconstruction, the doctor would use my products. So I was in there every single day, hanging out in the operating room and loved what I did, sold some power equipment. And one day my boss said, "Hey, you know, I need to meet with you." It was a Friday. And he said, "Hey, you know, I want to go to this Starbucks over in West End in Nashville." And I was so excited to meet with him because I just had this amazing trial run. It was supposed to be this capital equipment sale. And I was in the operating room and all these things went wrong with the doctor's surgery with the competitor's product. And it was a perfect segue into me building this portfolio with this particular hospital and this doctor. And I was so excited. He wanted to use our stuff. Completely unexpected. They call that like just throwing a dog a bone every now and then. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with him with a smile on my face at Starbucks, and he proceeded to fire me.
What?
And I'll never forget the feeling that I had. It was just total shock. I was like, "Dude, what's going on? Like, I got this fancy sales award a few months ago. I'm working my butt off." And that's when I learned that nobody was going to look out for my financial well-being but me. And it was, you can work as hard as you want for these companies. You can do everything possible, put in your blood, sweat, and tears. And at the end of the day, they have to do what's best for them. So no one was going to look out for me but me when it came to my financial well-being. And that's what started me on the entrepreneur journey.
Everybody is displaceable in sales and definitely in the corporate environment. One of the things that drives me crazy about working for other people. But some of us are designed to be entrepreneurs. We really love the concept of working for ourselves and having power to control our own destiny and create as much financial freedom as we can potentially want. But a lot of it actually boils down to discipline and working hard and or working smart, employing systems. So I'm really diving deep into that, reading a lot of books this year. So let's dive into a little bit of built to rent stuff. As you left this corporate environment, how did you get into the development side? When you decided to become an entrepreneur, what led you down the path of development, or did that come later?
Yeah, it came later. I definitely did not start in development, though. I joke, I definitely chose the fast route when it came to education, and this isn't necessarily a good thing. It was school of hard knocks. The third real estate deal I ever did was a new construction home. So I started with a flip that was about an hour and a half away. Didn't know which way to swing a hammer, but I was going to give it a shot. So I started driving neighborhoods, doing the traditional driving for dollars thing, sending out the mailers, boom, one hit. Fumbled through that first deal, made a little bit of money on it. We literally took $30,000 and then just dumped it into marketing. And I joke that that kind of led to a few more deals that produced some profit. And if you've ever seen the scene in Batman where the Joker slides down the big pile of money and then pours gasoline on it and lights it on fire, that's what we were doing with marketing dollars. And so we were taking 100% of the profits that we'd make from these wholesales and these flips and just dumping it back into the business. And that's what allowed us to grow and scale, investing in masterminds, coaching, you know, marketing and ourselves. We really didn't take a profit the first 4 years. We profited, but we just dumped it all back into the business. And over that time period, we'd built this acquisition arm that was working out really well. So we knew how to find off-market deals. Then we're like, man, all these contractors suck. Let's start our own contracting business where we can just do the work ourselves and control the timelines. So HBG Construction was born and everything was going great. We were scaling. Well, then we ran out of money. And I'm like, man, we need to bring investors in. I can't use all my own money and then scale this thing. So that's how HBG Capital was born. And at that point, when we were able to take all of our money out and use third-party partner money to really grow the portfolio and do these things, things were working out well. We graduated up into doing spec. So it was a lot of scattered projects. Imagine having to run to a bunch of different places. Our construction team was very spread out. And after we'd done, 40 or 50 deals that way, we're like, what if we just did all these deals in the same area?
Yes.
And so that led us to doing land development and ground up construction in the same area. So things became a whole lot easier. And then, as you know, interest rates, you know, went up, you know, the market kind of pivoted a little bit. And we said, man, we really need to start hanging on to a few of these things. We've sold some stuff to other build to rent funds. And if we have sold it to them at these prices at X, man, if we're building it for Y, it's got to be a deal for us. So we then pivoted a little bit and started doing build to rent as a strategy to help diversify our portfolio. So we didn't just jump into it. It's definitely a gradual process that we, as of today, we're about to go up, ground up in about 109 lots, and we've got probably over 400 in the entitlement and rezoning phase. Where we really add value is finding the off-market deals by aligning ourselves with the cities that we invest in, and adding value to the homeowners through rezoning their land for higher density and being able to, you know, give them a higher purchase price on it. That's really where we add value. It starts with identifying what the city wants, what their vision is, and then reverse engineering and going to those areas and having a one-on-one conversation with the homeowners and how we can help them and help the community.
The homeowners. So you identify a piece of land and then you go to the neighboring areas and talk to the homeowners, because this is the main thing that a lot of people don't realize when it comes to development and construction, is that the neighbors can try and veto you. They can say things like, hey, we don't want you to come in. It's going to add traffic. Mm-hmm. We like it quiet here. We like it rural, all these other things. So when you're talking to these homeowners, are you talking about like fixing their houses, or are you talking about, hey, we want to come into your neighborhood and give you something that you, that's beautiful, that you want in your neighborhood, that's going to help increase the value of your property? What kind of conversations are you having with them?
Yeah. So that takes place usually during the council meetings, right? Mm-hmm. When you're meeting and talking about it, the initial conversations are, hey, we've identified this area that the city or council is willing to support a higher density development in. And then we go and we have those conversations with the homeowners and say, hey, are you wanting to sell? Your home's worth $350,000 on 20 or so acres, whatever it is. What if we could give you $700,000 for it? And that's why we're able to close a very high amount of deals, because we're able to offer them a lot more than what it's worth. And that's where we really add value to our investors and our business, because we're able to add a ton of equity on top of it from taking a piece of land where there's only one home to a piece of land where there's 70 homes. Now, when we're in those meetings and you're getting all the pushback, and the reality is there is no way you're going to make everybody happy. That's just the reality of the situation. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it. But we really do try to add value to the community. And when that's your intention, it's hard for a lot of people in the community to fight against that. Sure, you're going to have the people that are like, man, I don't want the construction in my backyard. We had a lady one time who had a horse farm. She rescued horses for a living, and that's what she did. And she had a problem with all the construction that was going to be in her backyard. And I don't blame her, because that's her passion. She's had this horse farm there for 30 years. And so she was very heavily against it. She was going around from door to door, knocking on doors to try to get a petition against this development. She was putting flyers on doors. I mean, she had rounded up and gotten like 60 signatures and was trying to get people to these meetings to make a ruckus. And to overcome that problem, we just sat down with her and we said, what's the issue here? And once we understood what she was trying to do, and we said, let me ask you something here. If we rezone this piece of property and the city supports it because they've designated this area to be high density, then what do you think that's going to do to your farm out back? It's going to increase the value. and we're going to come to you and we're going to want to buy your land. And then you can go buy another farmland that's further out for your horses and put a bunch of money in your bank account and have the funds to have a paid off home and be able to support more horses by buying an even bigger tract of land. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we started speaking in terms of her interest and not ours, which is what everybody should be doing, all of a sudden we had a fan and not an enemy.
Yes.
So that's, we try to do that with as many people as possible during these council meetings. You're not going to make everybody happy, but when you're trying to invest back in the community, people do see that and you will get more buy-in than opposition.
Okay, cool. Thanks for clarifying that, because I didn't understand. Sounds like you actually buy houses with big tracts of land that you can develop on and not just find the land and then talk to the neighbors about what you guys want to do.
Either or. Sometimes both.
All right. I want to also kind of inquire about the land. Do you guys buy some land and then just flip it? Or every time that you guys buy a piece of land, is it with the intention that you guys are going to do build to rent subdivisions?
So we always have the intent of taking it all the way through. If somebody comes, like, you know, we've got a whole list of national builders on our buyers list. We've got a list of build to rent funds and everybody that buys this kind of stuff, because we've been offered stupid deals where we'd be dumb to walk away from it. We just sold a tract that we were going to build some townhomes on it, and we put all the roads and infrastructure and everything in, and LGI Homes came and knocked on our door and bought us out. And we said, shoot. And so, you know, the investors got their money back, their returns faster. They were super happy. We took a huge portion of the profits and we're happy. So we've got such a large pipeline at this point. There is no way we could build everything. I'm sitting on 500 probably plus lot. I can't build 500 homes a year. There's no way. So we're at the point where we have to move some of this other land to some of these other builders just because we don't have the capacity. So we cherry pick the very best deals for ourselves, and that's what we'll keep.
So do you guys have the intention to put options to purchase land with the sellers of them? And then if you can get the right entitlements and zoning changes, then you complete the option to purchase. Is that how you guys do it?
Yeah, essentially we do a contract with a due diligence period and say, we'll buy it if we can meet these parameters. So we put it under contract. We put a little bit of earnest money down, but we don't buy anything until we basically have approvals from the state. Yes. We can go pull a grading permit. So all the risks at that point have been removed. The value is there in the land. And at that point we buy it. So we take a little bit of risk by paying for the geotech, the endangered species report, the environmental and the civil engineering site plan, but we're willing to take that risk because it's worth it.
Okay. Speaking of risk, there's different phases of development and each of them have different risks. Sometimes developers will pay out of pocket for the land and then raise a little bit of money for the infrastructure and then syndicate the actual vertical development. What is the process that you guys go through? Are you guys raising for the infrastructure and then, or are you raising for it all at one point? Tell me about the different risk profiles at each phase of the game and how you guys work with that.
Yeah. So one of your risks is being able to exit the deal. One of your risks is cost, obviously. And the other big risk is your market risk. And there's several things that we do to mitigate all those risks. One, exit risk. We're typically using the same lender on the horizontal and the vertical. That's what they want to see, because that same lender is going to take us out of the horizontal, go into a vertical product, et cetera. Now, one of the things we do to help minimize that is we raise equity on the front end from investors. So when we syndicate a deal, we'll sometimes raise 100% of the funds just to do the horizontal. When lending is tight, like right now, and the debt market is kind of scared, skittish, and kind of sitting on the sidelines, they're not as willing to do, you know, lending. And so what we do for the horizontal portion, if we have to, is it'll be 100% equity from investors. You know, we'll knock that out in 6 months, 8 months, however long it takes. But at that point, we don't have a bank note sitting. It's all equity. So we can sit on it if we have to. That's the worst case scenario, right? We don't have monthly payments. We don't have a note coming due. We're good. And at that point, once we get it done, well, now we can go vertical with it, because it's much easier to get a vertical loan than it is a horizontal loan right now because of the land development risks. And that's how we mitigate that risk. So we do a pretty good job of raising equity to take out a lot of the exit risks. And we make sure that we've got some pretty good lenders lined up. We're not just pigeonholing ourselves into one lender. sometimes we're having to drag two or three to the closing table just to make sure nothing falls through. So we got a plan A, B, and C. So that's how we take care of the exit risk. The second risk was the cost risk. What do you do there? So we actually started our own supply company. Not a big supply company. We're not trying to compete with ABC Supply or Builders First. We just have a warehouse where we stash all of our own building products. Nice. And what this allows us to do is control one, the supply chain issues. So we don't have exposure to more market risk. Our products aren't just sitting waiting to be finished. And two, it helps us control the cost. When we're able to buy products from Turkey and Mexico at 25% of what it costs here in the States, is a huge, huge savings. You got to be willing to do what other people are not willing to do in this day and age in order to compete and stay in business. Because we've got crazy inflation, especially in the construction industry. We got rising interest rates. You've got to be able to combat that. So you've got in price suppression. At the same time, you've got cost increase. So that's squeezing everybody's margins, and you've got to figure out a way to do that. So by having all the materials on site and being able to significantly save on the cost of those materials and pull from them whenever we want, we mitigate market risk and we mitigate the exit risk by being able to lower our cost. So that's the second risk that we manage, the cost, and that's how we do it. The third is market risk, and that's basically having multiple exit strategies. So we want to make sure that if it's going to be a build to rent development, and that's we're kind of pitching to investors here, hang in there with us for a while. We also want to make sure that it underwrites for build to sell. And that's one of the reasons why we focus on entry level products, is because less than 10% of all the homes being built today are entry-level products. You just can't find them anywhere because it's so hard to find affordable land and build affordable products. And that's really why I say our value starts at the very beginning when we rezone the land, because that's how we build all the equity into it. We offer the homeowner a great deal, and we can build in millions of dollars worth of equity through increasing the density of the land. It starts right there. And so that's how we mitigate the third risk, which is market risk, is making sure that it underwrites for multiple models. And at least we're in a model that has very low supply and high demand, despite interest rates. I don't care what interest rates do. Everybody needs housing. And if you can't afford a house, you're going to rent a house. So we're either going to be that person that you rent from, or we're going to be that person that you buy from in an entry-level home. Millennials, who make up the majority of the buyer's market, it's over 30% now. They're at a prime home buying age, and they want something that's entry-level.
And new.
Yeah. And new. No headache.
Right. Yeah. Because a lot of these people, if they want that home experience and they want to buy a house, but the interest rates are making it hard to buy, but they still want to live in a home, they're perfect people to put into one of your build to rent projects. Because instead of living in an apartment where you have a neighbor or somebody attached above you, below you, to the left of you, to the right of you, and across from you, and with a little tiny balcony, you get a home experience with a side yard on both sides, a backyard, a privacy fence, a driveway, you know, all the stuff that you have like as an actual homeowner. And then the residents end up staying there for much longer than they would in an apartment, even if the apartment is A-class or whatever. You brought up something that's very interesting, which is that you create affordable housing product, even though it's brand new. A lot of people are kind of, when they build, they decide to build A-class stuff. So we kind of do the same thing where we build, it looks like A-class, but we rent it for B-class, right? It's got crown molding, stained floors, amenities, walking parks, dog parks, luxury faucets, et cetera. All the beautiful things that you want in a brand new home, sometimes even technology. I'm curious about numerous things here. I want to go back to the equity raising, because you mentioned horizontal equity. You raise money at that point, sometimes with all cash, no loan. Do those horizontal equity providers stay in the deal after the horizontal is done, or do you pay them out? Do you only raise capital from people that want a double dip where they get paid on the horizontal and then also get paid on the vertical? Tell me about the raising capital side of things. And then I have some other things that I want to ask you about exit strategy.
Yeah, so they stay in the deal. We tell them, hey, look, this is going to be a long-term play. We've got multiple exit strategies. Hey, we might get bought out after we do the development. We might get bought out at the point where we're going vertical and somebody else wants to come and buy it, or we rent it out, or we sell it. Any kind of cash flow event. And that cash flow event's usually if we're getting bought out by a national builder, if we develop the land and the lots, put all the infrastructure in, or build to sell when we sell it, or build to rent when we either refinance down the road or sell that deal to somebody else.
Now, I'm on social media talking about the differences between build-to-sell models and build-to-rent models, because I see this kind of trend across the country where the guys that are building houses with the intent to sell are kind of pulling back and slowing down, whereas the guys that are doing build-to-rent developments kind of models are actually scaling it up in a lot of cases, or at least staying even, because their intent is not to sell to an individual at the end once the house is done, but to sell the entire subdivision off to a single institution or fund or something like that. Are you seeing that there's a different profit margin in each of these models? It's obviously great to have multiple exit strategies and then be able to sell at any point when you force depreciation. But are you seeing that builders across the country are struggling if they have the intent to sell and that they're slowing down? Tell me about the difference between these two models, build to sell, build to rent.
Honestly, I've seen a big drop off in both, because the build to rent guys, there's a lot of interest rate risk, right? The Fed's higher, they've raised the interest rate higher than they have since the 1980s. And that's got everybody concerned, because when you have to back into a long-term loan 2.5 years after everything's built, that significantly impacts your cash flow, your NOI, and that impacts what the development's going to be worth. So I've definitely seen people pumping the brakes. The guys who are buying, they want a certificate of occupancy finished product. Like, they'll look at that because they can control they know what the interest rate risk at that point is when they're going to buy it. So I don't see any build-to-rent funds building the actual developments anymore. The conversation seems to be more around like, hey, Mr. Builder, if you can build it for this price and sell it to us, we'll go under contract with you, but you take all the risk of doing the development and mm-hmm. Acquiring the land, and we'll be your end buyer when you come out of it. I do see them still doing that. I'll bet it maybe a little bit slower pace, and then they've completely backed out of actually building them. So that's what I've seen on the build-to-rent side. The build-to-sell side, if you look at the starts nationally and here locally, they've fallen. The interest rate hike scared a lot of people. I think it's going to be very interesting this fall and this winter when all of this new inventory that was supposed to be built doesn't hit the market. That's going to be doing very interesting things to the supply, especially the new supply of homes. So I've seen the starts fall off. Just about everyone I know is having to do some kind of buyer incentive, 1-3% down, bringing in a mortgage lending partner to add a percenter to the buyer's incentive to either buy down the rate or cover the closing costs. Everybody I've seen is doing something like that to try to incentivize buyers to come out of pocket a whole lot less. So on both fronts, they've definitely been affected by the rise in mortgage rates.
So being in the build-to-rent space, much like you, my builders and my vertically integrated contractors and general partners that are on the development side, they live in one place and we tend to stay close to where they live. But I get a lot of questions from people all over the country like, hey, we see you as the build-to-rent guys. We got this land in Kansas City, or hey, we're doing stuff in Portland. And we don't go out there because that's not where we're based. So we have to turn a lot of business away. But I'm curious about this. Like, when it comes to market selection, people do build to rent in different markets. And a Phoenix, Dallas, Atlanta is going to be a whole different game of doing build to rent there versus in some of these smaller markets, secondary, tertiary markets, where you can buy land cheap. The city and the government is in growth mode. They want to provide affordable housing for their growing cities and for the people that they want to keep in their communities and counties. Tell me about the differences that you've seen, or I'm not sure if you pay attention to what's going on in Phoenix or Portland or in other places where they're also building. How mm-hmm. does that compare to where you're building, and why, in addition to being there and staying locally focused, what are some of the other benefits of staying in the markets where you are currently investing? For, I think you're in Nashville, right? Or somewhere.
Yeah. We're in Nashville, Tennessee, Middle Tennessee. And that's where we've always been. So I haven't expanded in other markets. So I might not be the best guy to ask on how Nashville compares to other market, but I can tell you why we invest in Nashville. So here's a couple of reasons why. I'm going to break it down from starting from the top, looking at some of the macros, and then drill down and maybe some risk mitigation on some of the micros. So from the macro perspective, when we're looking at doing these developments and having these multiple exit strategies, including build to rent, rent growths are obviously important. And are people continuing to move into this city or not? Nashville has been one of the top 10 fastest growing cities the past 7 years. When people are moving into an area, That means money is moving into an area, and that provides some insulation against economic contractions. One big question I ask myself when it comes to investing in just about anything, doesn't matter if it's stocks, bonds, real estate, is money going to continue to pour into this asset class during an economic contraction, or is it not? And when you got people moving to an area, that's a yes, people bring money. The second is the demographics of the area. Nashville's very centrally located. The tourism is year-round. It's not cyclical by some of these areas like Miami. You've got tons of tourist dollars that are pouring into here. It's also an area that, I joke, everyone sort of kind of knew, but COVID revealed. And that was that you have business-friendly states and you've got non-business-friendly states.
Correct.
And there is just billions, hundreds of billions of dollars pouring out of non-business friendly states and going to places like Texas, Florida, Tennessee, because we didn't shut everything down. And so again, when you got money moving to an area, that gives you some insulation. So that's another reason why we really like Tennessee in general. Nashville on a local level is further incentivizing these large businesses like Oracle, AllianceBernstein, Amazon is building downtown. If you just look at the amount of companies that are coming and setting up shop, it's huge because the city is incentivizing on a local level businesses to move here with further tax incentives. So another great thing about Tennessee is we have no state income taxes. So there's a great migration of businesses and people moving from like California and New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, some of these high tax states, and they're setting up here because it puts more money in their pocket. When you've got businesses moving to an area, you've got jobs, which means people, which again means money is moving to that area, and that provides another layer of insulation. So those are some of the macro reasons why we really, really like Nashville. Now, from a local perspective and risk mitigation, looking at some of the micros, we control everything in-house. We find the deals off-market. We've been here for 8 years. We know the market really, really well. And that allows us to mitigate some of the risks. So we can find deep, discounted off-market deals through rezoning. We provide the value. We build the equity in the deal. Our construction company manages it because you got to think, I think some of the biggest mistake investors make when they invest in these syndications is they're usually dealing with the sponsor. The sponsor's the face. The sponsor's the one raising the capital. I don't see a ton of people doing a lot of research on the operator. Who's the person actually taking down the deal? Who's the contractor on the deal? Because that's a huge risk. If that builder that this sponsor's partnering with, if it's a new relationship, they haven't worked with them before, or maybe they have, and that builder just bites off more business than they can chew or goes belly up or decides to retire, that is a huge, huge risk. We don't like that risk. So that's why we do it in-house, because we're able to control the timelines, control the costs, and mitigate the risk of that development. So those are just some of the reasons why we really like Nashville, Tennessee, for both the build-to-sell and the build-to-rent model.
Yeah, another benefit of having a vertically integrated developer as part of the general partnership team is that they're incentivized to do very high-quality work. If they're just general contractors, if you're a build to rent or some kind of subdivision developer and you're just paying somebody to build it, they're not going to be really interested in doing anything more than they're just getting paid to do because they don't have anything on the line for themselves, right? Do you experience this too?
Oh, yeah. Whenever you can have somebody that has skin in the game, that's the best way to do it. We're actually looking at trying some builders out to do some of these other developments because we like the model, right? It eliminates overhead. It requires us to not have to having to hire another team to go and manage this project.
That's part of the scaling.
It's part of scaling. We've got pretty good back-end systems and process with our CRM and our cost control systems where we can still have the leverage on the development and see how things are going. And worst case scenario, take it over and do it if things don't go work out. But I love that model for scaling because it does make it a lot easier. The new question you have to ask yourself and the skill you have to get good at is really honing down your ability to find and select the right builder. And then I love have them having skin in the game. Hey, give them some equity in the deal. Give them a piece of it. Bring them into this because now you have aligned their incentivization with yours and the investors.
Correct. Beautiful. Okay. Speaking of investors, you mentioned you have a capital division or a portion of your company dedicated to the raising of capital. How did that come about? How do you run it? What do you do to raise capital?
Yeah. So HBG Capital is our firm, and our website is hbgcapital.net. That's HarryBobGaryCapital.net if you want to check out what we do. But really what we're It was born when we ran out of money. We'd done so many deals with our own cash and we just couldn't grow. And so we first put our own money on the line with these new construction deals, you know, flipping houses. So we had worked the muscle on the construction end of things and acquiring the deal and made the mistakes with our own money before we invited outside partners and investors to come and join us. So that it was born out of the need to scale and pull our own capital out of the deals to invest it in the company infrastructure, hiring systems and process, and having some powder on the sidelines in case things go wrong, because they will, save for a rainy day. Why? Because it's going to rain. So that was how it was born. How we raise capital, there's no surefire way that brings in more than the others. We do podcasts like this. We have our own podcast. That's a great lead generation tool. We try to provide value to other people who have the audiences that we're going after and try to help them in some way, shape, or form. We've gotten a lot of traffic that way. We post on social media every single day, trying to deliver some type of value add content. What I would tell somebody who's just starting out raising capital, or maybe you've raised a ton of money, either or, if you don't have a target avatar that you're going after, you're making a mistake. Because you really have to have a target avatar and really understand what their needs, their wants, their motivations, their insecurity, and what their fears are. Because when you can start creating curated content around those insecurities, around those fears, around those needs, around those wants, and showing how the benefits of your organization aligns and solves those problems, that's when you're going to get people's attention. That's when you're really going to start making some traction. So we get a lot of lead generation sources from that. We've got an email list that we've built up over the years. It's probably 5,500 subscribers. We deliver weekly content to them. A lot of people who invest with us are other entrepreneurs that already have additional streams of income. They already have a business. They're not interested in being an operator. They don't want to go off market and find these deals. They don't want to go and manage these deals. They don't want to put all the property management, everything in play. They just have a check and they want to invest it, and they want additional streams of income arriving in their bank account as passive income. That's all they want. And so because I know that, that's what kind of content we put out. So we put out a lot of content as well. And we've gotten to the point where we get a ton of referrals. Nice. We heavily invest in our customer experience roadmap because we've learned that the better experience you can give your investors as a sponsor, as a capital raiser, the more they invest with you. And they usually bring a friend after you've turned their money a few times. So we've gotten to a point where we've got people they're referring people to us. They're writing bigger checks. We're able to turn their money for them and give them a great experience. So they bring people. So referrals are another way that we're getting new leads.
Amazing. Okay, cool. Before we go into the lightning round, I just got one quick question. Are you thinking about starting a fund at all for multiple built-to-rent subdivision developments, or you think you're just going to continue to do one-off syndications?
You know, we have looked at the fund model. There are some intricacies and some nuances that make me difficult to wrap my head around. I've met with some attorneys around it. I think that we're going to have to go towards that at some point in the future. When you do a fund, any new investors that come in automatically invest in the deals that are old, and vice versa. The old investors automatically like invest in the new deal. So I have not figured out a way, or I have not had counsel on how to properly structure it. I'm a very simple guy. You raise money for one particular deal, you put it in a syndication, that money is allocated towards that deal. I haven't quite been able to figure out how to properly structure the fund in a way where there's easy accounting and all of the deals
the accounting is never easy. You have to pay somebody to administrate it. They do have this thing that I've been hearing about. Some people refer to it in different languages, particularly when you're talking to attorneys. They all have their own unique language. Is kind of like college football. They're running the same plays, but they use different play calling. So there's this thing that I've heard of as either a super fund or a deal by deal segregated fund or a series LLC, where people can invest into a fund, but they get to see the PPM before they invest in the fund, and then they can decide which of the deals they actually invest in. So that might be something you could check into with Kim Lisa Taylor or other attorneys.
Yeah, I'm looking at Avestor. They say
they have a program just like that too.
Departmentalized. Yeah, I've heard.
And they do the administration as well. I haven't had those guys on the show.
Yeah. What about you guys? What do y'all do? Do y'all do syndications, or do y'all have a fund? Have y'all been able to figure this out?
Right now, we're still getting started. So we have a 98. We do only 506C. We have a 98, a 158, and a 241. And they're in different levels of different phases of development. I think we want to go into the fund model, but right now we want to prove the model first, prove the go full cycle on some of these. And then instead of doing one single syndication where a deal is attached to the fundraising, we're going to attach the business model and it's only going to be built to rent in certain markets and say, when you raise for us, it's going to be diversified into multiple markets, but using the exact same model, this is what we're going to do. But that's down the road. Right now, we're still doing one-off syndications.
When you figure it out, call me. I'd love to pick your brain.
We'll definitely, I definitely would love to stay in touch with you and continue to do some networking and growing together. So let's dive into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Best vacation I've ever taken had to be going to Playa del Carmen, Mexico with my fiance. Yeah, man, that was just, oh my God. The food, the service, the people, the culture, everything was just absolutely wonderful. One of the best times I've ever had.
Yeah, you got cenotes on one side of the highway and then clear blue waters with white sand beaches on the other side. It's just fantastic there. I love it.
Yep.
All right, so favorite book of any kind?
Man, it changes, but I can tell you Who Not How by, I think, Dan Sullivan. That changing that mindset was really impactful for me. One of the biggest tips I give people when it comes to hiring is hire strategic partners, not employees. If this person can't build out the department and show you ways that you can be grown and punch holes and gaps and show what the inefficiencies are in it during the interview process, don't hire that person. You need to hire strategic partners. And I got that advice from that book.
Yeah, the co-author of that book is Benjamin Hardy. He's got a new one out called Be Your Future Self Now. And I'm really looking to diving into that one. Very cool. How about this? How much of your success do you attribute to mindset?
I think that's the foundation.
Right.
Everything builds upon the mindset, because getting started and turning your first dollar and growing your business, it's extremely difficult. It's not going to be easy. And really the only way to get through it is to have a really rock hard mindset. Well, how do you do that? I think it's remembering where you came from. There's a really awesome motivational speech by Dwayne Rock Johnson. I think he's talking to like the Golden State Warriors, and he's like, man, you know, whenever I'm going through a difficult time, like I remember the bad times when I had $7 in my pocket, and remembering where you came from. So I use that, and then keeping the end goal in mind, the future, why I'm working towards this, what I'm doing. Those two things have really helped during the tough times.
Good stuff. How long do you want to live?
121 years old.
That's my, I swear to God, that's the exact same number that I have on my manifestation or my intention. That's crazy.
Good quality though. I'm doing everything I can to like
you
stay
have
healthy.
To imagine yourself healthy
for that long.
Yes. You
good
have guys
life.
Imagine yourself healthy, because if you start thinking about yourself being like all decrepit and like struggling, that's exactly what you're going to manifest. When you think about yourself at an older age, think of yourself healthy, and that's what you're going to bring into reality. Biggest difference between who you are now and who you were in high school?
I feel like my mind has been opened in so many ways. I see the world differently. I would compare it to waking up. My mind was just so shut off. The first self-help book I ever read that started this whole journey, and I attribute a lot to, is Think and Grow Rich. That's used to think that life was happening to me, and now I think that life is happening for me.
Yes, that's a famous Tony Robbins philosophy. I love that. Okay, how about this? A short answer on this question. Best way to raise capital from your perspective?
Call friends and family.
Okay, very good. What do you love best about being a build-to-rent developer?
Investing in the future.
Okay, cool. How about this? What do you love best about being a travel junkie? I think you just went on vacation for like 60 days, right?
No regrets when I'm on my deathbed.
That's fantastic. You also mentioned before the show that you're into high-end steak grilling. What's that all about?
Oh, man. I like buying Wagyu steaks from Japan, Australia. There's so many different cuts of meat out there. It's just a fun hobby. I love steak. Food brings people closer together. And I didn't have, you know, I love my mom. God bless her. She listens to this. But her food sucked growing up. Most of the time it sucked. And so I've noticed that I can bring people closer together, my family, my friends, through creating amazing dinners. And so that's a big piece of that.
That's fantastic. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Man, that's a really deep question. Yeah, I'd say so. It's that's a deep one. You know, like the whole spiritual thing is probably something I could get a whole lot better at. But yes, it definitely has had an effect.
If you live the golden rule, that's all you really have to know. And that's a very spiritual philosophy. It doesn't have to be religious or, like, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about God. Just be good to other human beings, guys. That's all that you have to answer in terms of this particular question.
Yeah. My spiritual philosophy, be the change you want to see in the world. Awesome. There you go.
That's fantastic. Okay. How about this? Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I've never had a near-death experience, but I do remember being 24 years old. And this is a funny segue since you mentioned spirituality. I grew up Catholic, but I don't consider myself super religious like my mom, who's a Catholic school teacher. I do believe in God. And I remember graduating college and I worked at Ace Hardware. I couldn't find a job. My dream was to break into medical device sales, which is funny because I did it eventually and then got fired from that dream job. But for a year and a half, life just wasn't going so hot. It was, you know, 2012, the economy sucked. It hadn't bounced back. And I, you know, was making like $8 an hour and my life was just terrible, right? And like I said, you know, the mindset was horrible. My life was going nowhere. I thought I was a victim, but at least I had the woman that I was going to marry. Like that was the one thing I had going on. And you know, I was so happy to have her. And then she left me. And I remember just everything just sucked at that point. I had to move out. I didn't even unpack all the stuff at my new apartment. It was like a hoarder's house kind of, where I just had these pathways to my room and bathroom and kitchen. And I just remember like, just life freaking sucks. And I was going through that really, really rough time. And I remember walking around on college campus. I'd graduated for about a year and I went to the church and I just sat on the church doorsteps at like 11 o'clock at night, and just cried and prayed for a change. And literally like less than a week later, I got a call from an employer who ended up hiring me, and I got my first career job, which is what eventually led me to being here today. So I do consider that a miracle. I think that that was God answering me.
Yeah. When you pray from emotion, there's a greater probability that it's actually going to come to existence. I remember doing something very similar when I manifested my wife. I was crying for my dream person and they finally came. So when you want to attract something, do it with a lot of emotion, and that's the way you should approach your business too, I would think. So that's my invitation to everybody out there. Last question of the day, brought to you by Shanna Amigo. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
Oh man, right now I'm really focused on trying to build an amazing life for my family and help as many people reach financial freedom as possible. I really dream about the idea of, you know, some way, shape or form, doing some philanthropy, helping entrepreneurs grow their business. I just want people to say this man really took care of his family first and was able to impact the rest of his community through his efforts in philanthropy.
Fantastic answers on the lightning round. Thanks, man. That was cool that you were vulnerable with us. All right. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my company, and our sponsors, Syndication Pro, the Family Office Club, and Pitch Decks. Check out their offers at capitalraisershow.com. All right, brother. Brandon, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
If you're somebody who's interested in learning more about building your legacy, achieving your dreams, and impacting those close to you through passive income secured by unique real estate investments, you can learn more at our website, hbgcapital.net. That's harrybobgarycapital.net. And I joked that the .com was stolen. Someone beat us to it. We've got a free ebook on there, Recession Resistant Real Estate. Learn about the different strategies that we invest in and why. We've also got another ebook on there called 100 Questions Passive Investors Should Be Asking Before Investing. It's completely free. I wrote that book because I got a phone call from one of our investors who asked if I could help one of his friends out. And his friend, upon answering the call and saying, sure, you know, what's going on, lost all of his investment in a deal. And he was asking what he should do and what his next steps are. And unfortunately, he was kind of past to the point of help, but I gave him some stuff. And I thought to myself, man, if I could do something just to prevent this from happening one other time to one other person, it would be worth it. And that guy's problem was he did not know what questions to ask before investing. So you don't know what you don't know, but you can arm yourself with all the questions you need to ask a sponsor or an operator before jumping in a deal if you head on over to our website. We've also got a podcast, Recession Resistant Real Estate Radio. Go check it out. It's geared towards growing businesses, systems and processes, real estate and passive income investing. I have a lot of fun with it. So you can check us out there as well.
Fantastic. All right. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or build to rent subdivision syndicator or anybody else that's scaling in the syndication space?
Yeah. Hey, create the problem first and go after it. If you problems are good things, go create some problems so that you got something to go chase.
Cool, Brandon. This has been a lot of fun, man. Good getting to know you. I look forward to following your progress and staying in contact, my friend. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks, Ruben. I appreciate your time, man.